Well, the show is Stand to Reason, friends, and I'm Greg Kokel, the host. Enjoying being here. Glad you're with me. All of that stuff every week. 30 years doing this. And it's still, as I think back on it, as just I reflect on it, it is one of the most satisfying things I do. It's not easy. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying. It isn't like fun, but it's satisfying because I think that it makes a difference. And this is just a little philosophy that I have about ministry. I wasn't planning on saying anything about this, but just passing it on. It's not so important that you like what you do. What's important is that you are doing something fruitful and virtuous and good and durable. And sometimes you're going to like it and sometimes you're not. But the things that are important are the things that we give ourselves to. And whether we feel like it or not is not really the relevant question, though it is the question of the age. Okay? Couple of quick announcements here with that little homily behind me. And that is, got a question last hour that I didn't get to answer, but it was simply about reality conferences. We have three of them coming up in the next few months. One in Washington, that would be in the Seattle area, October 16 and 17. Remember, reality is what we used to call Rethink. So it is our Student Apologetics Conference. Reality Student Apologetics Conference, or Reality Apologetics is the way we refer to it. And this is where we appeal to the younger crowd, to the junior hires and the high schoolers and college kids. And basically, it's our aggressive commitment to passing the baton to the next generation. The most important generation in any generation is always the next generation. And so we are working hard through these conferences to do that with our best speakers and our best material and our most fun stuff. Youth conferences characteristically in the past have been shallow teaching, low on content, very high on fun. Okay, we want to treat young adults like young adults, not like big kids. And we want to treat them like disciples of Jesus of Nazareth, which is what these kids are, which is why they come to our conferences. And these conferences, and we have now five of them around the country, have characteristically, I think the average is around 1,600, 1,700, or 1,800 people at any given event. Now, we just lost two in a row because of the strange circumstances that we're having right now. Our Orange County, which was 2,600 and some change last year, and also our event down in where is that? in the South, Birmingham. Thank you, Amy. I'm reading my stuff here and I can't think of the town. When in Birmingham, we had canceled last year because of the current events. And we're still looking for a host for that area, by the way. So if you have some ideas about that, you can contact us and let us know. And Danielle, as in D-A-W-N-I-E-L-L-E, at str.org, danielle@str.org is the contact. If you have an idea of a new location for our reality conference in the South or the Southeast in 2021. So if you're attending or work at a large church that's that itself is interested in hosting, we're glad to talk to them. But we have October 16th and 17th of this year in Washington, November 13th and 14th in Minnesota. We had 23 or 2,400 in our inaugural event there in Minneapolis last year. And then in Dallas on February 26th and February 27th, okay? And these are big events with great instructors and great teachers. We're going to be talking this time around. Truth is not ice cream. That's the theme. We're not relativists here. we're standing on reality, and that's what we're going to be talking about from a lot of different angles. You want information about that? RealityApologetics.com is the place to go. And the caller who dropped off last hour simply wanted to know, can adults come? To which I say, yes, of course. We're not checking IDs at the door. We are targeting young people, but young people bring their kids. I'm sorry, young people bring their parents. And grandparents and youth leaders, and sometimes whole youth groups come with the parents. So this is wonderful. This is fine. Our target is for that younger group. We want to pass the baton to them, but some of the people in their immediate community that are already passing the baton are people that need to be there too. So whoever will may come. That's the basic principle here. Now, we've been talking as a team, especially what I call my young guns, Amy and John and Alan and Tim, the people that you are most exposed to in terms of podcasts and writing and blogs, etc. We've been talking about how we can best be equipping you and encouraging you during a very tumultuous time. Last hour, I was telling my friend Marty, 2 years ago, I was thinking I would never have imagined we as a culture could be at the place that we're at now. That was 2 years ago. And now I'm thinking, 2 years ago, I could never have imagined we'd be here where we're at right now. And who knows what it's going to be like in 2 years from now. There is a tremendous amount of turmoil in the culture. And the turmoil touches on spiritual things. In fact, underlying all of the craziness that you see going on, there is a spiritual dimension that is the determining factor of this chaos that's going on. None of this is innocent. It's not just things that are happening. There's a spiritual world out there, and there's spiritual currency involved in all of these kinds of things. Now, it's not always easy to figure that out, and sometimes we can't. But folks who've been around longer to understand how worldviews work and how rhetoric works and about how demagoguery works and how falsehood works and lies work when they're made to look like truths and all that stuff. Well, we, and that's us, we have experience with that. We can help out. We can offer some counsel. We can offer some insight. We can give you some ideas that will help you to navigate through crazy times. And what we hope to accomplish, let me put it this way, the way we plan to do it, our MO, as it were, is to give you pieces of truth and insight that you can take to the bank. Not necessarily giving you all of our opinions about all the social circumstances and all a bunch of stuff that's in play culturally, but at the core, at the foundation, principles that will be things that we can all hang our hats on as followers of Christ. And so over the next few months, we're going to be doing this more to be providing order in your mind, at least, for the kinds of things that you're facing in the culture, such that you can give an answer that's appropriate to the circumstances and consistent with the truth, okay? And in that spirit, so to speak, I want to read to you something that was written by Alan Schliemann, and it was just posted a couple of days ago. And this particular piece is so timely, and it's so important, and it is so well written, in my view, that I'm just going to read the whole thing instead of read a couple lines and then blather on, saying it not as well as Alan said it in the writing. And on a regular basis, our team is publishing things that go on our website and get sent out to our constituency. And this is simply titled, How 2020 is Taking a Toll on Your Soul. He actually did a podcast on this too, dated July 1st. I think that's what I was told. So he's got it, or maybe that's August 1st, I don't know. But this piece is dated, the one I'm reading is dated August 1st. So he's if you want to listen to him, you can find it on our website. And if you want to read it, you can find that on our website too, or on one of our apps. We've got fancy fast apps that you can download to your phone and get to this stuff pretty quickly. But here's what Alan Schliemann writes as he is reflecting on the challenge that we're facing in our culture right now. He says, I'm going to tell you something that will explain what you're likely feeling about this turbulent year. No doubt you've witnessed a series of tragic events unfold before your eyes, and you probably felt an inordinate pressure to say the right thing about each one of them. Like you, I've been hesitant to comment for fear I'll be blasted by someone who sees things differently. It's been frustrating, it's been fatiguing, to say the least. And I believe this short comment by a Texas pastor explains the reason why we feel this way. And here's what he wrote. So now he's citing this Texas pastor. Could it be that God didn't wire us to carry every event taking place in every part of the world at every moment as if it were ours? Could it be that technology has produced a faux omniscience and omnipresence that is hurting mankind and not helping it? End quote. Alan continues, this is an important assessment. Through the internet and social media, technology has given us a ringside seats to every event, tragedy, and evil act that happens in any part of the planet. That is not something we're created to handle. Now, let me just repeat this line because this is at the heart of his exhortation, and I hope source of comfort to you. That is not something we have been created to handle. It's made possible, though, because of the internet. Though technology often helps us, it also creates two problems that hurt our souls. Faux omniscience, that would be like false omniscience, and faux or false omnipresence. Up until the last fraction of human existence, we've only had to carry events that directly affect us. When he means carry, he means we only had to kind of worry about it and carry the burden on our shoulders. Those things right in our immediate circles, okay? And he describes it here, our family and friends, our local community. Today, however, with the internet and social media, we can witness every evil event. And if we miss it, a recording is readily replayed online. The carnage is funneled through our eyes and embedded in our souls. What we witness can be in the next town, the next state, or on the other side of the planet. No matter where it happens, we see it. It's like we're everywhere. That's his faux omnipresence he's talking about. But it's a false omnipresence. We're not actually there, but we're made to experience these events like we were. We soak them in and feel the pain that others feel, albeit to a lesser degree. We scroll through our news feed and witness another tragedy, and then another. And in a matter of minutes, we've watched multiple evil events. It's overwhelming. Now, God, who is omnipresent, can handle all that evil, pain, and tragedy. He's capable. He has the emotional and psychological bandwidth to witness his creation repeatedly commit evil and not become overwhelmed. Finite humans, though, we're not God. We don't have the capacity to handle inordinate amounts of evil. This faux omnipresence hurts us. And our faux omnipresence leads to faux omniscience. We think we're present at these tragedies, so we're tricked into thinking we understand what happened. We saw it online, after all. It was in high definition. And because we witness these events, we're expected to know the truth about what happened, make an immediate evaluation, and say the right thing about it. Finite humans can't be perfectly accurate, though. Even still, we comment, we post, and we emote. We argue, and then we divide. Our online debating adds another layer of stress. All this happens after a single tragedy. There's more, though, another horrific event is right around the corner. We repeat the cycle and the stress builds. This faux omniscience hurts us as well. Now, though online technologies can hurt us, and he says here, I'm not a Luddite. He's pretty sharp technically, actually. He says, I don't doubt the scientific advancements have helped us communicate and protect people and care for vulnerable people and do many other good things. Progress, though, comes with a price. And then he writes, though, Inherit the Wind, the movie, or the book, rather, is a disastrous retelling of the Scopes Monkey Trial of 1925. I do resonate with one of Henry Drummond's speeches in the movie, and so he cites it here. Quote, progress has never been a bargain. You have to pay for it. Sometimes I think there's a man who sits behind a counter and says, all right, you can have a telephone, but you lose privacy and the charm of distance. Madam, you may vote, but at a price. You lose the right to retreat behind the powder puff or your petticoat. Mister, you may conquer the air, but the birds will lose their wonder and the clouds will smell of gasoline. Close quote. And Allen continues, technology that makes the internet and social media possible might move us forward in some ways. But we pay for it in other ways. We experience a faux omnipresence and a faux omniscience, and that causes us to carry all the hurts of the world. Could it be, as he's citing here now the earlier quote, could it be that God didn't wire us to carry every event as if it were ours? And this is Greg speaking now, that's a fair question. And of course the answer is no, he didn't. And this is what Alan is encouraging us to consider. He didn't wire us to carry all of these burdens. Okay? Now, he continues, naysayers might object. We need to know what's happening around the world. We need to stay abreast of current affairs. We must learn from our collective experience. Well, he says, I agree. It's important to learn from tragic events that occur outside our immediate community. But we can become overwhelmed by the barrage of the negative news. We're not created to soak in every tragedy as if it were ours. Progress, like Drummond says, has never been a bargain. You have to pay for it. And it takes a toll on our souls. And then he concludes with a kind of application here, and you may realize what's coming. But first, before I get to that, can you feel the weight of what he's talking about? I feel it all the time. Now, I actually apply the RX he's going to offer here, and so it doesn't hurt me as much as it does hurt so many other people who turn out to be just overwhelmed with everything that's happening. I have such a small peek into that world that I can... You know, that enough, just that little small peek. I don't watch the news. I don't read newspapers, okay? I don't wake up to the news. I don't go to bed to the nightly news. I don't do any of that stuff. I don't have a TV. I got a screen that plays DVDs. That's it. Even so, I get overwhelmed. I don't surf the web. I don't read everybody's Facebook. My wife was reading one last night. I just looked over at the screen and I saw something that was written there and it got me really angry. I don't want to get angry just before I go to bed. Okay, so here's Alan's RX. Perhaps, then, we should take better care of ourselves. Not a bad idea. Here's what I suggest, he writes. First, unplug from the internet and or social media. Unplug from the internet and social media. This is mandatory. Set up times when you walk away without taking sneak peeks. Now, I'm not saying you never use that, but it's got to be managed. You just have to turn it off. You have to have a fast or a rest from it. My girls want to go online. I say, okay, you're going to use that screen? You got 30 minutes and you turn it off. We're trying to manage that as much as possible. And we're careful about where they go. But he's saying we should do the same thing for ourselves. And well, what do you replace it with? Second, spend time in nature. For example, take a hike through the woods Observe the simplicity and the beauty of God's creation. I love to notice delicate flowers or watch the gentle dance of birds in the trees. It helps me escape, is what he writes, for a time, the harsh reality I must eventually return to. Now, by the way, we eventually return to that harsh reality, especially us, because it's our job to make sense of it and help communicate to you. But this is one of the things that we're passing on, Alan is, on how best to deal with these things. Third, first, shut it down. Second, get outside. Third, pray and discern when and where you can shoulder other people's burdens. And find friends who can help carry yours. This is a biblical mandate. Finally, develop a habit of giving thanks to Jesus, the one who took our burdens. Without him, we'd be in bigger trouble and hurting even more. He encourages us to come to him and promises you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Matthew 11:29-30. Nicely done, Alan. Well written and really, really good advice. And by the way, if I can make this transition, we were talking about strategic partners and the help that they give us. Strategic partners make this kind of thing possible. In fact, that's what he says. Thank you at the very end of his letter for being faithful to help carry my burdens. You've helped lift me up for this service, and I'm grateful to you. That's Alan's close there. And he's thanking the partners that we have, because this letter is going out to, but now it's available to everyone. Our partners make this possible, and we're thankful for them. All right. Like I said, this is available at str.org. We've had a lot of reports of people passing this on and paying it forward to other people. We hope that you do as well. You get a copy of it, read it again, and maybe even again, for it to help you. We're not made to bear all of the world's burdens. All right? Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. More in just a moment. You know, if you've gained anything from listening to Stand to Reason, I'd really be thrilled to hear it from you. I love to take your questions, of course, but I also want your feedback. So here's what you can do. Head over to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating and a review. That kind of thing really helps us to get the word out so more ambassadors for Christ can find the show and become equipped to stand confidently. And you never know, I might just give you a shout out on the air to show you my appreciation for your positive review. I value you as a faithful listener. I look forward to reading what you think about the show. Thanks.
Are you looking for a way to be more involved in the STR community? When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group helping STR-trained Christians to graciously defend classical Christianity and classical Christian values. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our planning and ongoing work. As a strategic partner, you'll enjoy an automatic 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and bi-monthly insider updates, so you'll get the inside scoop on what's going on in the ministry, and you'll know what you can pray for. Become a strategic partner in the Stand to Reason community today by visiting str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate? And choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email ocean@str.org. That's ocean@str.org.
Okay, friends, Greg Kokel here, and ready to take your calls, 855-243-9975, or internationally, 562-424-8229, and we have, from Fargo, North Dakota, Seth. How you doing, Seth?
Doing fine. Thanks for taking my call, Greg.
You're welcome. Hey, I have a question. I know South Dakota is pretty mellow right now with all the COVID stuff. Is North Dakota mellow also, or are you guys locked down pretty tight?
We're pretty take it easy, you know, just kind of, we're kind of the state that kind of takes things as they come. And so we were locked down maybe for about a month, but we opened up pretty quick again. You know, we've got a few more cases now with this second wave, but Sure. We social distance at a baseline, you know?
Right. Well, look, there is going to be more cases. There's no question about that if people come out of their houses. The question is, at what cost? And, you know, one person – I'm not going to get into a big deal about this. However, I will say this. I heard this very, very early on, and a person made an observation on another radio show, and they said, we, as Americans, we have always been willing to risk our lives to protect our way of life. And this seems to have changed radically in the last few months. Anyway, just something to think about. Okay, Seth, what's on your mind?
Sure. So I've got this friend from work. He's a pretty staunch atheist, naturalist to the core. I tried to kind of press him on some things. He just doesn't think that anything metaphysical or supernatural exists. And I said, really, you can honestly tell your wife that it's not love that you have for her. It's just your brain chemicals firing. And he said, yeah, that's what I've told her. And I said, well, what about free will? I said, you can honestly treat your kids like they don't have free will. And he said, no, I think free will is likely an illusion.
Huh.
And I just was curious what you thought his response would be to someone who thinks that free will is an illusion.
Sure. I think it's a fair question. What you're doing is coming up with what appears to be clear case counterexamples regarding his naturalistic metaphysic. All he thinks that exists are molecules clashing in the universe. And that's it. And of course, if that's the case, and natural law then is what governs them mechanistically, that's what makes science work, well, then everything is going to be determined. All physical systems are determined. And by the way, if people want to go into quantum mechanics and all that other stuff, no, they're not deterministic. Well, then science can't work because it requires that a given state of affairs that's established always leads to another state of affairs. That's called experimental repeatability. So it should be not controversial that if a physical world is all that exists, then we are determined in the strict sense because all physical particles are responding merely to the conditions prior to them. So as I like to put it, because I think it's a good visual, is the word, it's just a complicated set of dominoes falling. Now, that may be true. I don't think it is, but I want you to think about, and this is what it's fair to challenge your friend on. If it is true that there is no freedom and we are determined, then his conviction that we are free cannot be said to be a sound, true, rational conviction. Because if we are determined, there is no rationality. People don't come to conclusions based on good reasons. They come to conclusions because of the necessary prior physical conditions that determined them to believe that. So all he could say is, I am determined to believe in determinism, and you are determined to believe in freedom of the will, but we can't say anything more about that. And in fact, even saying that we can't say anything more about that would be a mechanistic, deterministic response. What you can't have in determinism is reason and rationality, because that requires freedom. We deliberate based on evidence that gives us reasons to come to conclusions. That deliberative process is not a process that is determined by physics and chemistry. It's determined by the nature of the things we're considering. So I'm just wondering, it would be fair to ask, Seth, I think, it would be fair to ask your friend. So let me see if I understand you. You believe that you're a determinist. I mean, that things are strictly determined in a naturalistic world, right? Why do you believe that? That's the question you should ask him. Now, if he gives any other reason than saying, well, because I'm determined to believe that, then he's not playing fair. If he says, I have reasons, then you could say, wait, are you free to adjudicate between the reasons and come to a conclusion? Or are all of your reasons also equally determined? And then if they're all equally determined, if he bites the bullet and is consistent, then you say, well, why are you talking to me right now. And all he can say is, because I'm determined to do so. He certainly can't convince you of anything, because convincing is not possible. Convincing is an intellectual exercise where we bring ideas and evidence and reasons and rationale to bear on a concern, and then we weigh those and decide what we think is true based on the evidence.
Yeah.
So that's the point I would press with him.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah. So in a certain sense, determinism could be true, but it could not be the case that we know it's true, because knowledge requires reasons. If you just get lucky, that's not knowledge. You just got lucky. You got the right answer, but you have no reason for it. It's not justified true belief. Beliefs are not justified by anything. They happen in virtue of the circumstances and the physical conditions on his view. Science could not work on his view. Okay? So that's the suicidal element of the view that he's offered. But there's more to this, and I think you are on a great – you're really on a great impulse, and that is to give counterexamples, things that are things we are all aware of that are clearly not physical. Thoughts are not physical, all right? And they may – entail physical activity, but my thought of dinner coming up here in an hour or so is not a physical thing because it doesn't have physical properties. It has propositional properties. And one of the simplest way I know to demonstrate this, and I've done this with audiences a number of times, and some people think it's a physicalist think it's a trick, but some will acknowledge, hey, this is, you got a good point. And what I do is I invite the audience to close their eyes and imagine their mother or their father, if they don't want to be sexist about this, washing dishes at the sink. And then I ask the question, now that you got that picture clearly in your mind, here's my question. What color shirt is that person wearing? Then I say, okay, open your eyes and tell me. And then people tell me all the different colors. I see bright yellow myself. My mom washing bright yellow canary yellow kind of shirt, okay, a blouse, whatever. Then I ask the question that really matters. Where was that? Where was that thing that you saw, that image you saw? You saw it with such clarity that you could tell the color of the shirt the individual was wearing in what you saw. Where was that? I'll tell you one place it wasn't. It wasn't in your brain. Because you couldn't crack your brain open, and even in principle, and see your mom washing dishes with a yellow blouse on. It was somewhere else in a non-material realm. That what you saw was not physical or material. Oh, I know, but my brain was doing this, that, and the thing. Well, your brain probably was doing all those things. Yes, and the C fibers are firing, and the synapses were doing. Yes, it probably was doing all that. So there you go. Well, wait a minute. Did you see synapses? Did you see C fibers? Did you see electrical brain activity? No, you saw this image. I'm asking where the image was. So there might be a physical component to what was going on. I'm not asking about that. I'm asking about the non-physical component. Now, that's not going to be persuasive to everybody, but it ought to be, because it's a good illustration or example accessible to everyone that we have features about our mental life that are simply not physical. And if they are not physical, then they are not beholden to naturalistic forces. And this is why a very well-known atheistic philosopher named Thomas Nagel, N-A-G-E-L, wrote a book titled, and I'm looking over my shoulder right now to see if I can see it on my rack here, but it's something like why the naturalistic neo-Darwinian conception of the world is almost certainly false. Now, remember, this guy's an atheist. But he realizes that because his specialty is philosophy of mind, that consciousness cannot be reduced to something physical. And that includes all conscious states, all our thoughts and our reflections and our imaginations and our dreams and all of this. They can't be reduced to something physical. And therefore, if our metaphysic is completely materialistic and naturalistic, it entails only physical things, it's not adequate to cover the ground. It can't tell us everything about reality, and therefore it fails as a comprehensive worldview. Now, this is interesting. This is coming from a guy who's, he knows his stuff, Thomas Nagel, and New York University. And, you know, he's somebody to contend with, and he took a lot of heat for this book, but he's got a point. And so your impulse there, Seth, to give clear case counterexamples to show that physicalism, which is what your friend was promoting, is just clearly false. I think that was a good impulse. You're on the right track there. So you've got a self-refuting situation when he says that I know that there's no free will, and you have clear counterexamples to a materialistic worldview, which is driving his commitment to determinism. Hmm. Make sense?
Yeah, thanks.
Anything else, Seth?
Well, I had one thought about him saying that it was an illusion. It seems like you would have to be somehow removed from reality to know that something was an illusion, similar to how a magician knows that one of his tricks is an illusion because he's outside of it. But I didn't exactly know where to go with that.
Hmm. Well, that's what he said, that you'd have to be outside of reality. You can't be outside of reality. That's kind of a nonsense statement, being outside of reality.
I'm just saying, for him to make that statement that free will is an illusion, he would have to be outside of, basically, I don't know how he can make that statement, basically, as a human being within reality.
Well, I agree with you. I don't know how he could make that statement, but for the reasons that I gave you, free will is necessary to even come to a conclusion about something like there is no free will. Okay, so, you know, that's like, in a certain sense, a no-brainer. And that's a bad pun, actually. But it's a minder, not a brainer, so to speak. Okay, so I think this view is doubly dead, and for very good reason. But there are lots of people who want to hang on to it because it's the only thing left for them if they want to cling to physicalism and a materialistic worldview. So I think you're in a good spot there. And like I said, I think you have good instincts as well. All right, buddy.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Seth. And let's go to a commercial here and back for more after this.
Would you like Greg, Alan, or Tim to come speak at a location near you? If so, just send a quick email to darcy@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers are accomplished and compelling presenters who address, from a biblical standpoint, topics like abortion, homosexuality, and evolution, as well as apologetics, theology, and evangelism. They're available to teach lectures and seminars, preach sermons, and lead workshops at single events or weekend-long conferences. Their aim is to help Christians like you effectively engage the culture around you with knowledge, wisdom, and character. To learn more, just go to str.org and click on the training tab at the top of the page.
Since Scripture calls Christians ambassadors for Christ, how do we fulfill that role when it comes to Islam? I submit the answer is exactly the same way a political ambassador would fulfill their role. Ambassadors do two things. They learn and engage. You see, they learn about the people they're going to visit, and then they engage those people. And ambassadors for Christ should do the same. We need to learn about Islam and then engage Muslims. Now, the challenge that many Christians face, though, is that they don't know much about Islam. And even when they think they do, they're often misinformed. And this can lead to unhelpful stereotypes, prejudice, fear, or syncretism. That's why I've created a video training tool called A Closer Look at Islam. And that's to equip ambassadors for Christ who are ready to heed the call to learn about Islam and engage Muslims. Now, my goal in this resource is to provide believers with an accessible introduction to the most important elements of the Islamic faith. And that way, they can draw upon this knowledge of Islam to more carefully craft their message when they meet Muslims. I also wanted to combine this knowledge with practical tactics. For example, I show believers how they can determine which beliefs and practices are truly Islamic and which are not. Also, I explain how to respond to the most common objection that Muslims raise, and that is, the Bible has been corrupted. A Closer Look at Islam is available on DVD or HD on demand. You'll find the link to our online store at the top of the homepage at str.org.
I have in front of me the book that I was referring to by Thomas Nagel. And actually, I gave you a poor rendition of the subtitle. Amy put the real title up here, and during the break, as I would grab my copy, Mind and Cosmos is the title of the book, Mind and Cosmos. And actually, I think it's reasonably accessible. It's only like 127 pages long. It's a hardbound book, and it's a small format. So, you know, it's not hard reading, and if you've been able to get through, you know, William Lane Craig, you certainly can read this kind of stuff. But the subtitle is Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. He wrote this in 2012 and has been somewhat persona non grata ever since in his circles. But he's trying to be honest to the evidence. And I have talked about this before, you know, people who say, and they are significant people who say that consciousness is an illusion. I just want you to think about that for a moment. Now, one of the new atheists famously says this. I'll think of his name in a minute, or maybe Amy will type it in there. For the UNC guy, famously says this. You can look it up on YouTube and type in, you know, not Michael Ruse. No, he's not one of the new atheists. He chastises the new atheists for their foolishness. I got to look over my breaking the spell. Hold on. Daniel Dennett. See, I had to look over my shoulder at my atheist books section. Daniel Dennett says it. He says, you know, consciousness is an illusion. Now, why would he say such a thing? You can go onto YouTube and just type in Daniel Dennett, double N, double T, and consciousness is an illusion. There he is sitting in a chaise lounge, you know, drinking a martini or something, and he's having a chat with somebody on the porch, and this is what he says. Now, why must he say that? Because consciousness is not physical, and therefore there's no place in a physical world, physicalistic world, for it, so it must not be real. And instead, it's an illusion. Now, what I'm telling you is what he must say in light of his prior commitment to his worldview. But if you're going to have a worldview, the worldview has got to explain the world as it really is. And so when he encounters, and this happens with lots of people, it's a common human trait, and even religious people and Christian people can do this as well. It's confirmation bias. When he encounters something that does not fit in his worldview, instead of modifying his worldview, he just tosses this thing out. It says it's not real, like free will in that last call. Or like consciousness in this particular case. Thomas Nagel, he knows consciousness is real and it doesn't fit in the current naturalistic worldview. And therefore, he thinks there's something wrong with the worldview. So my hat's off to him. What Nagel wants to do is to expand naturalism beyond materialism. He doesn't want to bring God into the picture. That's for sure. He says that here. But he wants to show that the mind-body problem, which is what we're talking about here, has ramifications for how we understand the cosmos. And if materialism and naturalism as currently construed cannot make sense of something as obvious and universal among sentient creatures, not just humankind, as consciousness, then it's not an adequate view of reality. And so he's toying with this idea in this wonderful book, Mind and Cosmos. I want to go back, though, to Daniel Dennett, because Daniel Dennett I'm struggling with the best way to describe his mistake. I think I usually say this is one of the dumbest things I've ever heard an intelligent person say. maybe that sounds uncharitable, but he is an intelligent person. No question. Professor Daniel Dennett. But that is a dumb thing to say. And it's not just a raw ad hominem here. There is a reason why I think it's dumb. And it has to do with the nature of what an illusion is. So Dr. Dennett wants to deny the reality of consciousness and reduce it to an illusion. But what is an illusion? And what kinds of things have illusions? Do rocks have illusions? No, of course not. Why don't rocks have illusions? Because rocks aren't conscious. Only conscious things can have an illusion. Because an illusion is when a conscious self is being appeared to in a false way. So if conscious selves are necessary to have an illusion, then how could the consciousness itself be an illusion? What is having the illusion of consciousness? Is an illusion having an illusion? You see how that doesn't work. That's why I think it's kind of dumb. Although the man is not a dumb man. And it's axiomatic, I've said this many times, that very intelligent people make very foolish mistakes in thinking when it comes to spiritual things. Okay? Now, by the way, I was talking, I think, last week or a couple weeks ago, maybe about being involved politically, and maybe it was last week when I talked about my concerns over a teacher who said, we should not have any, no hint of politics in our endeavors. Did I do that on the show? I think I did. Okay. So I got this text then from somebody or a message that was handed down to me, maybe came through the website, asking about this. The question is worded, I'm an associate pastor and I've always believed Christians should be involved in the culture, including shaping politics, to reflect godly biblical values and truth in their community, state, and nation. However, I hear my pastor referring to passages such as 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 4, to which I will turn. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 4. I love 2 Timothy. For many, many years, it was my best, my most famous passage. It is a book, the last book that Paul wrote. He is passing the baton to his disciple Timothy, who is a pastor. This is a pastoral epistle. And he warns Timothy not to get bogged down in inconsequentials, okay? And he has this famous verse, the second verse that I remember ever memorizing, though I don't ever remember memorizing it. I just remember remembering it. But it's an important one. The things which you have heard from me, Paul writes to Timothy, in the presence of many witnesses, it's a public message, entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. So that's the famous 2 Timothy 2:2 passage about four generations of passing the baton, what we do with our reality conferences. We pass the baton. But then he says, next verse, suffer hardship with me as a good soldier of Christ. And then says, no soldier in active service entangles himself in the affairs of everyday life so that he may please the one who enlisted him as a soldier. And then he gives an illustration, too. If anyone competes as an athlete, he does not win the prize unless he competes according to the rules. And then another illustration, same point, the hardworking farmer ought to be the first to receive his share of the crops. Now, what Paul is doing there is he's telling Timothy to suffer hardship and not be distracted, and gives him three illustrations of hardworking individuals that are not distracted inappropriately, but focused on what really matters. Now, this particular writer then picks up on that. He says, I hear my pastor referring to such passages as I've just read, where Paul instructs Timothy that the soldier doesn't get entangled in civilian affairs, but rather tries to please his commanding officer. And his pastor apparently interprets the passage to mean that Christians should not distract themselves from sharing the gospel, distract themselves from sharing the gospel by getting involved in politics. And he wants to know my response to this interpretation. Now, I do not think this is what Paul is telling Timothy here. I do not think he's setting up a standard by which he says, all you do is preach the gospel and don't get distracted to do anything else. I think what he's saying is that we have a job as Christians to do, and we should not be distracted from that job, doing the job, suffering the hardship of doing the job by other things that are frivolous and are unimportant. So this is not a false dichotomy here. It isn't like you either do the job and don't do politics, or you do politics, which is frivolous and unimportant, and therefore you can't do your job. Sometimes being a good soldier entails being involved in the public life. And think of William Wilberforce here, for goodness sake. And I have one of these days today where I can't think of simple things, where he got great counsel from a great saintly man to minister God's will through government, because he wanted to be a pastor. And by the way, 2 Timothy is a pastoral epistle. He's talking about Timothy as a pastor. Preach the word in season, out of season, he says in chapter 4. But some people aren't pastors. They're serving God as soldiers in other capacities, and that includes in politics. And so what William Wilberforce did is devoted himself to using the machinery of politics, which is, by the way, an authority delegated by God. It's a divinely legitimate authority over people. And he wanted to have that authority influenced by his godly viewpoint to end the slave trade and to outlaw slavery in the United Kingdom, which he did as a life's work and accomplished just a week or two before he died. Okay, now are we to say that, oh, he's entangling himself in civilian affairs? No, he's fighting as a soldier a different battle. So I think this is a wrong application of the passage. And Timothy had his particular role as a pastor, preach the word in season, out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort with great patience in your teaching, do the work of an evangelist. This is all in chapter 4. So Paul is giving very particular guidance to the activities of Timothy. But broadly, he's to do that and suffer hardship. Don't get distracted. Don't get off and living your life in play so you don't accomplish the thing that you need to accomplish, which is guarding the gospel, which is the theme of this book, and getting these other things done. But he's not telling Timothy, you have this very, very narrow bandwidth of activity that doesn't include political action. He was telling Timothy, do your job and suffer hardship. But other Christians have their responsibilities as too, and I think William Wilberforce is a great example of that. John Newton, that was the name I was trying to think of. I kept thinking of a John Adams, and I couldn't get Adams out of my head. John Newton, the author of Amazing Grace. The movie made by that title talks about what Wilberforce did. It's a great movie, except for it's a terrible characterization of John Newton. There's almost nothing true in that movie about John Newton. The whole characterization of Newton, apart from the fact that he's a former slave trader who became a Christian and wrote Amazing Grace and had a powerful influence on William Wilberforce, that's true, but all the rest of it's not. I mean, this thing that he's swabbing the deck with rags on and doing penance for his slave labor, that's just, no. He was a noble pastor and had a powerful impact in England during that time, and not just on William Wilberforce. But you see the point I'm making. Wilberforce had his particular area that he was to be a good soldier in. And incidentally, if we are committed to staying out of the public realm, whatever that is, and by the way, that's expanded radically, I mentioned last time, so that virtually everything is political now, then we have to stay out of almost everything. And these are things that have to do with things that the Bible is concerned about, like sex and marriage and relationships and the authority of government and how that authority is being used. all kinds of things relate to that. We get out of that, then we can't do the things that the Scripture tells us to do, because the Scripture doesn't say just preach the gospel. Get a tract, speak that tract, simple gospel, that's it. That covers the bases. No, it doesn't. And what happens then if we do that? Then who is the one who's informing, who are the ones informing the moral conscience of the authority that God himself has set up for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do right? Not Christians, because they're told to get out. So then the authority becomes informed by non-Christians. And, I mean, some non-Christians are good, noble people and have good moral instincts, but others don't. And we are facing that right now. The culture is being formed by an ignoble ethic that is being reflected in the laws. And, in fact, the rule of law is being worn down. And the substance of good moral law is being lost. Do we really want to say that Christians should not speak to that, that we shouldn't have an influence on that? So does salt and light expand beyond just giving the gospel? It seems to me it does. And it has been the case historically for Christians to do that. And I don't think it's a distraction. I don't think it's an example of abandoning our post or not being good soldiers and getting instructed and entangled in civilian affairs. There are lots of civilian affairs, okay, that entangle lots of Christians, and this passage has application to them. When I say civilian affairs, that means there's lots of nonsense that people who are Christians fill their lives with and leave behind no impact. There is nothing that will endure. Their works will be tried by fire and they will escape by the skin of their teeth, smelling of smoke, going naked into the kingdom, because all of their works will be wood, hay, stubble. Okay, don't want that. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Thank you for being with me. Give them heaven.